The story is that Vimalakirti was a layperson living in a 10-by-10 room. He was sick, and Shakyamuni sent Manjushri with 80,000 bodhisattvas to pay him a call. Vimalakirti accommodated them all in his room on 10-square-foot lion thrones. Manjushri asked, "Why are you sick?" "Because the whole world is sick," said Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti then asked, "What is the bodhisattva gate to the dharma of not to?" After Manjushri, they all gave their opinions. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti for his explanation. Vimalakirti was silent. So I thought it would be nice today to continue our exploration. Actually, I'm hoping to come up with an explanation, but that's doubtful. But our exploration of this, of what it means to be a home leaver. This is one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha, and a teaching that has been discussed and talked about through the many centuries now, and taken many forms. Originally in the Buddha's Sangha, to be a home leaver meant to renounce your life in the world and to give up your family, to give up your possessions, to have only your robe and your begging bowl, and also meant to take on the vows of celibacy and 100-some vows of the life of a renunciate. And so this was the path to work your way through your karma, come to terms with life. The path that the Buddha showed at first was this path of home leaving with the physical body. And the idea is you would not create more karma for yourself, and you would eventually become free. So there was the ordained Sangha, and there was the lay Sangha. Then 200 or 300 years after the Buddha's time, there was the arising of the Mahayana, the great vehicle, where this teaching was transmuted, and this great Mahayana way that we are a part of, that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is a part of. In the sutras of the Mahayana, these sutras that are attributed to the Buddha, that are stories about the Buddha, but did not appear in the world till several centuries after his death. And indeed, the appearance of the Mahayana, it's quite interesting to read the discussions of this, because there are different explanations. Were these teachings written in Buddha's time and discovered, or were they inspirations of people who were dissatisfied with the current approach, the way of the elders? We don't know, but there was this arising. And part of the text of the Mahayana is the Vimalakirti Sutra. And this was quite a radical sutra in that for the first time we have the appearance of a lay person who not only seems to be on equal footing with the ordained community, but indeed in many ways seems to surpass them. And so this idea of the Mahayana, that to follow the Buddha way does not necessarily mean we have to go to a monastery that we have to literally give away our possessions. But this spirit of home leaving, this spirit I love in this little story that comes from the Vimalakirti Sutra. Why are you sick? Because the whole world is sick. This is, I think, core to our way of Zen, to the Mahayana movement, this sense of identity with self and the world. This is the Bodhisattva ideal, that we don't do this work just for ourselves, that there is no self that is separate from the world. So each one of us sitting on our mat, our 3x3 mat, and of course all of the bodhisattvas, all of the 80,000 bodhisattvas come to visit us here. And all of the 80,000 demons and distractions come to visit us here. So we say that as we do Zazen, the whole world does Zazen. So this indeed is world work we are doing here. And this is a path of vow. And this home leaving that we provisionally hear in a boundless way called the Bodhisattva priest. This way of vow is the way for all of us. One of our visitors last night came up to me and said, so Mike and Bob, will they be sent off to churches where people will support them and they will have a life teaching the Dharma? And I said, no. So then he wondered what they might be doing. And I said, I have the same question myself. This path of being a priest, just as the path of taking the precepts, just as the path of coming to Sesshin, is a path of setting some clear direction without knowing. Because anything we know is simply our idea. I also had a young man come to me just the other day, who was visiting the temple and came to sit, and his question was, can I pursue the spiritual path if I'm in a committed relationship? And I said some various wise and pithy things that clearly made no impression on him. Finally I said, well, it's actually a mystery. And I rang my bell. The next day he sent me a nasty email saying, this is what Zen teachers always do. And he's totally right. that all of us long for some way, and we so imagine that way is somewhere else. If only I were like, if only. Why are you sick? Because the whole world is sick. As we sit, we are exploring what it means to be a human being. We are seeing again and again, and I think this is so important, we are seeing the power of habit force. In my day job as a priest, I am a life and leadership coach, so I talk with people about how to align their life with what they love. So the first matter is clarifying What is it that you love? What is it that is worth living for? What is it that calls to you? This is quite a question, because usually we're so busy just trying to survive. And we, I think by default, think the world is a place where we just have to figure out the rules, and if we figure out the rules and pull the right levers, then things will go our way. Of course, no matter how many levers you pull, no matter how successful you are, however you define that, in the end, it doesn't work. In the end, everything we have that we think is ours, we see, is just temporary, just provisional, not just the things we own, but the qualities and capacities of our mind. All of this will be given back. And so clarifying this matter of what is it I want, and moving, it's quite a different direction. Rather than trying to accommodate oneself, and of course important to know how to act in the relative world, but I think the primary question is, what is the direction? In service of what? As you sit here, what is it that brings you here? So we clarify this question, and then we are called upon, and our bodhisattva path is to act in the world. This is not a path, not a path for most of us, where we are called to spend our whole life in meditation. But this activity body, so how do you manifest your vow? And this manifesting of the vow, we could say, is what home leaving is about. Leaving a life where we navigate on contingency to leading a life where we navigate from the true heart, from the great love that called us into this world, to begin to say yes again and again to that. And I think the real challenge is this power of habit force, this way we're used to doing things, this forgetting that happens. We forget again and again. Of course, this forgetting is the central religious problem in every spiritual path I know. Enshrined in the great Christian tradition at the penultimate moment when Jesus is about to be crucified, and his number one Sangha member, Peter, says, "You can count on me, boss. I got it covered. I won't forget." And yet he's asked three times later on, just several hours, "Do you know who this man is?" He says, no, who? Who are you talking about? So there in the scriptures, here in our life, this forgetting happens. The day starts, maybe we have some clear intention, and by 9 or 9:30, if you're like me, maybe earlier, but we're caught up in the momentum. And here on the cushion, the bell rings, and we think, all right, this time I manifest my full vow, heart wide open, holding nothing back. And 5 minutes later, daydreaming about something else, wandering through the six realms. And I think until we know firsthand the power of forgetting, the power of this mindless forward momentum of our life, that we cannot begin to really address it. That this life of vow, this practice of vow, to come back again and again, because we will get lost. It does not fixate in the realm of clarity and love. And also it does not fixate in the realm of confusion and darkness. But we do navigate by vow. And this home leaving means leaving what we think we know. Leaving the opinion of how it should be and how we should be. And so we come together. Of course, each one of us, one of the 80,000 bodhisattvas. We just sometimes forget who we are. So we come here to make a vow, and we come here to rest in the support of Sangha, in the support of the 80,000 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So many of us often have to deal with this question of feeling alone. We talk about it so often, but it seems to be just part of where we go as human beings. So this path of bodhisattva priest, there of course is no path except the going forward. This work of Zen is the path of no path, the path of taking one step and then the next. The path of giving our heart to what we love. So the forms keep changing. What it means to be ordained in the Buddha's time, what it meant in China, what it meant in Japan, what it means now. We are part of this ongoing act of creation, of ourselves, of what it means, what Buddhism means now, what Zen means now. No Zen teacher can tell you. And if they do, you should run the other direction. But each one of us can know it for ourselves without a doubt. In the taste of our fruit salad, in the light coming in the room. So this is the invitation to live a life of vow, to leave aside whatever it is you think you have, whether you think you have insight and equanimity, whether you think you have confusion and only trouble. We are asked to give it all away and to step into this impossibly generous, impossibly mysterious life that is right here. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably and turn this way if you'd like. We'll have our Dharma dialogue. So questions, observations. Yeah, Jim.
I just really love how you pointed out that this tradition has been self-evolving since the beginning. You know, and that you know, I really feel strongly that we all here are really a part of something very real.
Right.
You know, and we're not alone. In the process, there are thousands of folks who came before and yet to come, but we have our own role to play, our own particular way to find to how to be. in this, and I'm really grateful for your courage in helping to stand up and to help create a space, and then let all of us kind of find how to fill it together. Mm-hmm. It's really extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is the tradition is not fixed, like everything else. So we participate in this great tradition by doing this work, not by simply saying, well, they did it like this 100 years ago, but like everyone who has encountered this, this is what we do. Yeah, thanks.
I love the phrase you use, Jay, self-evolve, because it really is us. It's not just evolving on its own. And it's kind of doing it by itself as well, without our doing it. We're just participating in something. I love that phrase. It's a turning word kind of phrase. Thank you.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little louder for the back here?
Yeah.
The hotel here.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Kate. Okay.
Something about the Vimalakirti image in the 10 by 10 space and the 80,000 bodhisattvas coming to visit brought up very vividly for me reminder of a letter that I got, a correspondence. This was from a prison inmate. And he is one of the people that I correspond with that I pretty much was sure I was never going to get through to. You know, I don't even know how. I mean, he was really a hardcore person. He'd been in protective custody because he'd had it out with gangs, and, you know, they had his name on the list of... Anyway, tough guy. And how he ever brushed up against Zen and decided to sign up for this this correspondence thing, I can't imagine. But, you know, we corresponded, and he seemed to find it worthwhile. And then the last letter that he sent to me, he said, and this speaks to your idea of an intention, forming an intention to move in a particular direction. It's clear that he no longer wanted to be part of that whole violent thing that was happening in prison. He said it was because he didn't want his daughter to have to visit him when he was in segregation. You know, that relationship meant that much to him. And so he was trying to aim for something else without really knowing what it was. And he said that one day he saw somebody who was on his particular list, you know, that he would like to get off into some corner and really let him have it. And he saw this person, and he looked at him and thought, that isn't really who I want to be. And so he didn't. And he said he hardly knew who he was at that moment. But he thought that perhaps he was becoming human. Mm-hmm. And he put that in capital letters, mm-hmm. Becoming human. And I thought that was a wonderful way to say what the practice of Zen is. This sort of not even knowing what you're aiming for, thinking it's here, but then discovering it there.
I love that not even knowing. You know, we all have an idea of who we are, and we're quite attached to it, right? And whether we think it's good or bad, at least we know. At least I'm the worst of the worst, you know. But I do think when we act in the moment, when we move in that direction, we don't know who it is.
There's a moment of intimacy.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
I'm sort of struck by your phrase, navigating by vow. There's something very sort of catchy and appealing, and I find myself kind of catching onto it and thinking, oh, I have a rule now. By vow. And I was thinking, but what about this home leaving? Isn't that meaning that we don't exactly even know what we're vowing? We're trying to give up all of what we knew or what plan we had about who we were going to be. So then I started thinking, navigating by vow means like taking one step forward or the boat, changing it this way and that way. How do I have any idea where you're going? Except that you are leaving some stuff behind. And you have some kinds of aspirations, but it's actually not a very useful phrase in some ways to tell you all about.
Oh, thank you. You've understood my true meaning.
Can you send him an email tomorrow?
It teaches
But for me, I thought, you know, when Jay started talking about throughout that lovely image of self-evolving, and then Melissa started, yeah, the self and intentionality, and then all of a sudden found herself drifting into, but of course we don't actually have much control over that at all. And there is a bit of a dialogue, but mainly our intention, I think, is a kind of surrender. It's an invitation into seeing the matter as it is and navigating from that place, and over, and several of us over and over again, you know, becoming human, except when we're the fox or the cat or the, you know, what other creature we might find ourselves in the moment. I struggle with this all the time. I mean, what is this ordination path? And for us, what does it mean for us? Because it isn't what it was just before Meiji. It's not even what happened after Meiji Japan. It absolutely is rooted in it, which itself is rooted in, you know, some things, rooted in other things, and in some very almost homeopathic way, goes back to the Buddha's crowd. And yet, there's something, you know, there is that something. And what I love is how we all participate in it, whether we do the formal ordinations or not. It's really important to us that it doesn't have to have that expression. But that sense of vow, you notice we talk about vow, but we never say the vow to what. I mean, it's a very wide, and I mean, there are some points in there that we can find, but mainly it's throwing our hearts into this great matrix, you know, into this amazing, strange, terrible thing that is life, with some intentionality, and then who knows where it goes.
When you were talking, Carolyn, two images popped into my mind. One is the one that a lot of us are familiar with, the koan, where somebody comes to a teacher and the teacher says, "Where have you been?" And he says, "I've been wandering around on pilgrimage." I really love that image of wandering around on pilgrimage. And then, you know, the teacher says, "Well, where are you going? Where were you going?" "I don't know," says the student. And the teacher says, "Oh, not knowing is most intimate." So we get to this, what's so close to our heart, as James was saying. The other image is, we have a friend who's the Episcopal priest down a couple of blocks down from here, and we did a program with him. He's a great admirer of St. Brendan, who is an Irish saint, and the story of St. Brendan, and there's this sort of text that I tried to read. He gave it to us. It's very bizarre in many ways to me, as much as Zen koans would be to him, I think. And he got out, he went, set out to sea with his fellow monks and priests in a round boat. Isn't that a great image? And it just went from island to island, and they have all these adventures. It's a little bit like the Odyssey. But I love that image of, you know, just you push out to sea in a round boat. It's not even a canoe or a kayak. It's not going anywhere, but it's carried by, you know, and I feel like that's the story of my life. I thought I was going somewhere, and I keep ending up on these different shores. Like, what am I, you know, hello? What's going on? And it's so you make the vow. His vow is to get in the boat and set out to sea.
A couple parts of the story, the koan, resonated with me. One of which was, why are you sick? Because the world is sick. This is something that often makes me feel overwhelmed with a lot of sadness. And then out of that sadness, for me, there arises this vow, which is, you know, save all beings. But that is also, you know, how... There you go on.
Yeah. And I think this is the precisely the most irritating part of Zen. and I think where Zen, for me, has it most true, it is saying, you know, anything... that the truth we want, and noticing how we catch on to, oh, now I've got it, right? Now I understand. Then the new self is created, you know, and not a problem in some way, but as we begin to see through this, that and the possibility of stepping forward without knowing. I think this is the great faith that we're called to, and the great freedom, right? This possibility that we could live not by rule. And also, as James was saying, you can't make it up in the sense that I think, for me, my experience is it's much more honoring what's already true. And so this question, who am I called to be, is not... So the good answer, or who I think I should be, is not it. But it's much more surrendering. So this is what I'm given. And then, who is it? Oh, it's Sister Helen Prejean, who wrote Dead Men Walking, a nun who's worked on death row. She said, I'm always watching what I do to see what I believe. I'm always watching what I do to see what I believe. And I think there's something, the proper order. We don't really know, but we're called to an act, and we have to watch carefully. Steve?
So this image of the round boat really is disturbing.
Is it disturbing or irritating?
Maybe both. It seems to me that if I'm going to set out to sea, I would want a boat with a front and a back, and a map, and a paddle at least, maybe a motor and a sail. And
yeah, how's that working out for you?
Where you end up is not necessarily, you know, where you intend to go, but to set out intentionally in a directionless vessel, you know, with no idea of where you might end up, doesn't really seem to be the best way to handle the situation in my life. I mean, it might turn out good, and then those are the stories that get told, right?
That's right, the others.
The one where the guy ended up in Ireland and landed by the pub or whatever, you know, is the story that gets told. And the guys that just, you know, end up in the middle of the Atlantic running into an iceberg, you know, no one ever hears from them again. But I'm serious, though. I mean, this thing about, you know, how much of what happens is intention and how much is just, you know, meeting the moment. There's a great tension there, and it doesn't seem to me that the answer is necessarily just don't worry, you know, just step in any direction and it's all good, you know, which the round boat kind of makes me think of, you know, just, oh well, you know, I just will go wherever I go.
What if any direction is good? Not that we have to keep going in that way, but what if it's really different?
Where's your vow? Right? I mean, that's the...
To step.
I'm intending to go
to step,
this way, right?
To step. My vow is to step into something and meet that and learn from that.
You know, there's a couple of things that occur to me here. It was something that, when you said the thing about Sister Helen and this, I act and then I see what I believe. There's new, I looked at Bob, I wonder if you know, but there's this new research in neuroscience that people act and then make up things cognitively to explain their actions.
Yeah.
which totally makes sense to me. That's the story of my life. And it's a wonder, and it's, you know, a millisecond before the cognition comes in and goes, this is what I was just doing. The second thing is there's a poem, and I can't remember it exactly. I'm not even sure who wrote it. I think it was Juan Ramon Jimenez. He's a Spanish poet. It always caught me, and a friend of mine used to recite it all the time. That's why I know it. But I never got it until this moment. And he said, there are three things that a sailor doesn't need when going out in a ship to the middle of the ocean. One is an anchor. One is a paddle. And the third is the fear of going down. Right? So there's some kind of a trust in something much bigger than little me, knowing, being carried in a certain way. That when I make the vow, I don't know what the outcome's going to be. I don't know what pub I'm going to land at. I hope it's one where that, well, I won't. but there's this alignment with something that I can cognate later. And as I'm on the path, I discover the path. But it's terrifying to trust that much. You know, this is the great faith. And the other image is this great cartoon that I've seen of a man on a tightrope, and he's holding the rope in his arms, and he's laying out the rope in front of him. So it's got, these are all images that resonate with our hearts, because if we look at the, you know, we think, I'm going to do this. You know, when I was 15, I decided, someday I'm going to be a Zen priest living at a temple. That didn't happen. When I was 15, I was interested in many other things, but not that. So I was interested in knowing the truth about reality at that age. And that propelled me. Those were like the currents of the ocean somehow. So, you know, who knows? But never even.
Right. I was going to, I was thinking just what you were thinking, Steve, but then I realized, okay, but we're putting our round boat into these waters. We're not putting our round boat into gang membership. You know, we've decided this is going to, you know, and then you could put your round boat into gang membership and want to wake up, and the man you're corresponding with is beginning to do that, and, like, that's probably going to change where he puts his boat, you know. But I mean, we're not just putting our boat anywhere. I mean, we're all here. It's amazing that we all took this week and dressed up in this stuff. And, you know, and we're here, but we don't know where it's going to take us. I mean, and that's the, it's where, I think it's where we decide to put the boat. And even then, we don't know where we're going to end up.
Yeah. And really.
There's a component to this that's not, it's St. Brendan. And when he puts his boat into the water, he's putting himself in the hands of God. That's that tradition that says, put yourself in the hands of God and everything will turn out all right. Ours is a little different. Ours is sort of like, put your hands in something unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're probably the same underneath it all, but that's where that comes from. You know, the round boat is, well, wherever God wants to place me, that's okay.
I think you just pointed to something really important, not the difference, but that God is a nice name for this mystery, this unknowable thing. Some people form it into a very hard meaning, but I think that, you know, like this priest that studies St. Brendan, he comes and sits with us. He doesn't appear to have a tie to God as a very specific thing, but it seems to have a lot of overlap with our taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You know, this taking refuge is homely verse. We leave home to take refuge in those three jewels. So it is, you can get lost a little bit in hard definitions. It's not helpful for me to do that. I know that there's something much bigger than me carrying this little round boat, but I don't call it God. But some people do. Some people I know very well do.
I guess what I was trying to say though is that within that tradition, that's what that story is about. You know, it's about placing yourself in the hands of God.
Well, actually, Christian mystics that I read use a lot of the mystery language and some of the same things. So I think people, even in that tradition, see it quite differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what the hand of God is. I mean,
that's right.
I'm not hearing an argument here.
Oh, no.
Julian and Faye.
Yeah, I've been listening to the discussion on it in sort of the form of a profound truth and a near enemy, as she saw yesterday. Because Zen practice has really, you know, messed with who I think I am and messed with my ideas of right and wrong and correct and direction and everything else. And the profound truth of emptiness is, you know, I really don't know what's coming next. I'm on that tightrope laying it out. And, you know, the near enemy is, therefore, whatever I want to do is okay. And, you know, and I mean, they're both there. And it just brings me back to practice and Sashin and the Sangha when I'm in that tension. Mm-hmm.
One thing I felt during this was I, like, sort of got annoyed at the bodhisattvas. I was like, you know, when am I sick and they come? It just seemed like, when does that happen? And of course it does, but just the same thing that Mike was sort of saying. It's, like, annoying when these people appear to you or this thing appears to you that you don't actually know what it is. And it's just, like, this vow to come back and to, you know, for kalpas and kalpas and save all these beings, and it seems easier when you're in the sickness and seeing the suffering to just, like, give up. So I thought it was interesting that the bodhisattvas came and not the demons, and that's, you know, that's what made the vow, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, and we don't seem to, it's like, you know, when you're in a hospital, you get to order the food. We don't seem to get to order bodhisattvas or demons.
Yeah. You
know, I'd like 17 bodhisattvas.
Just get the cello.
Yeah. And I think that this irritation, this disturbance, that there's something so important about it that really is central here. This is, you know, we want to fixate it and understand it, but yet this, you know, when you say, well, you know, how come, or how do I save all beings? There is, to me, such possibility in that, and such importance to be able to tolerate that. You know, the little self wants to paper it all over. You know, what's the catchphrase from this Dharma talk? And I'll just take that with me. But I think the invitation is to a life of constant disturbance. Somebody down here, was there a hand? No. Laura. Yeah.
I really appreciated a minute ago when you said your vow is to take the step. You didn't say that your vow is to take the step and then keep going down that particular path. You know, and for me it's connected to something that Willie said, was bringing up another tradition. Put yourself in the hands of God and everything will be fine. And what came up for me was, it depends on your definition of everything will be fine.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Because I want to get, you know.
Wait, I didn't hear you.
Oh, sorry.
Say it again.
Depends on what your definition of everything will be fine is. You know, and because everything may be fine may mean, you know, that's going to take you to gang membership, or that's going to get you killed, or you're going to decide to wage war on another country, or whatever that step is, you know. And so this, I can get caught in that phrase, you know, everything will be fine, like, because I want to believe, like, yeah, it'll all work out great, you know, just like a fairy tale. And the evidence in my life is that it doesn't always work out great. Sometimes it works out quite badly, and I get fired from a job, or I whatever your definition of badly is, you know. Again, depends on your definition, right? It turned out to be a really good thing.
well, that's so, the thing, the shape-shifting. We think we know what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, and the freedom that I heard in what you said was just vowing to take the step. And then seeing where I am, really seeing where I am. And then what this practice is teaching me over and over again is, hopefully, to be able to have enough space to then make a choiceful decision, you know, to really see where I am, and then do I want to take another one? Do I want to continue down this particular path?
Right.
Or shall I turn slightly and step a different way?
Yeah.
My vow is just a step.
Yeah.
And I think that everything will be fine is Julie's near enemy. You know, trusting yourself to God and everything will be fine.
I heard something different. In Julie's, I heard, and so everything I do is good, is okay.
A step in any direction is the same.
Yeah.
If I hurt somebody, that's, you know, that's just
whatever.
My step. Yeah.
So the similarity I heard was the whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And this, just going back to St. Brendan for a minute, I think all these people who got into those boats died. So, you know, you could construe fine in many different ways, but we don't have ever enough information to know what fine means. I don't think we ever do, but we think we do. We say, oh, this is great. Really? We have to be alert and suspicious whenever we come down hard on anything.
Three more here, Laura. Yeah.
I'm wondering how this relates to the teaching of whatever monk it was who said every day is a fine day.
Mm-hmm.
And the meaning of that. I'd just be interested in what you would say.
Could you go first on that? What did he mean?
What did he mean? So I'm supposed to answer.
Stupid Zen teachers.
I'm so annoyed.
I guess the way I've interpreted it is that somehow or other everything can be gotten through. Everything is doable.
Yeah, certainly that's one way to approach it. It certainly is, that story certainly hinges on fine. Like, what does it mean? Because it's clearly a nonsense statement if we take it on the I know what it is, and it's sunshine and bodhisattvas and, you know, loving and I'm sick. So clearly he's pointing some way through that, that it's not that kind of, there's some other kind of fine.
Yeah, and it reminds me of another teaching. I don't know if it was Pema Chodron or someone who suggested that we carry around the idea of, I'm really okay with this. Which is, you know, kind of an impossible thing, really, to be. But the idea, I mean, for me personally, it's a helpful teaching. It kind of stiffens my spine a little bit. I can survive this. I hear it as if someone else is saying that to me, and I think, oh, okay, sort of if you say so. You know, one part of me may be talking to another part.
And I think you're talking about skillful means. So sometimes it is these phrases or these teachings can be very helpful to keep us here when it seems like, we're going to die or it's too much. That how do we work to accept what's here? How do we give up the fight of it should be different?
And yeah, because the mind says it's nonsense.
Right, right. And that's the invitation. So where's the truth here? Lovely, thank you, Lord.
And in that case, in Masu, right?
Yeah. Yunmin.
Yunmin was, at an earlier part, a member of a monastery where half the monks died of starvation. We do actually can die. Yeah, in fact, all will. So that invitation, every day is a good day, is heavily freighted, and I wouldn't want it to just be if you set yourself in the right intention, everything will be okay. I think it has another angle for us here.
And what angle?
Well, and that's where I think that's the great struggle. It's in the Christians, with the Christian theme, which we've touched upon here a couple of times. What's her name? Who's walled up in a...
Julian
of Norwich she's walled in behind a the altar in a church, and that's her life is the thing, and she's the one who sings, everything will be well, all manner of things will be well. I think there's an invitation in here, in this case, that pushes us to maybe what the round boat does for us, maybe is where everything will be, okay, and in God's universe, and how do we encounter it, and what do we do with it? I love that one step.
Yeah,
it's just about to take a step.
And the other boat image, as long as we're in the nautical themes, is that one teacher said that being born human is like setting out to sea in a boat you know is going to sink. Because that's the, it's not, if living forever is what you're looking for, that's not going to happen in the future. So here we are in this boat.
That's the fear of going down line, and this Julianne, when she said that statement, she was very, very sick and dying, so there's these are all freighted with reality. They're not meant to be good as opposed to bad, fine as opposed to not fine, and that's why it's a koan. It's really, there's some very hard checking questions on that koan, and when you get to it, if you haven't yet, that are really heart-wrenching and purposefully so. How do you live an awakened life when everyone is sick? What does that mean, when the whole world is sick? How do you do that? So.
Thank you. So Aaron, and then one behind one.
So back to the koan. I was feeling pretty good about it. All right, so the bodhisattvas come, and they all have an opinion, and they offer the opinion. Does it mean, Jushi says, so what is your take on all this? And was it silence? Was
that yeah, it? Yeah.
So that's where, I'm left with the wonder. What does that mean? Because for me, silence is like, it's quite often, I don't know, so I'm going to be quiet. It's not coming from a place of, this is my answer. Well, so I guess it is an answer, but it's not this confidence. But, often I think of these koans when it's the master just waving the fan or something. It's coming from a place of knowing. So that's where the stickiness is for me. What does that mean that he said nothing?
Right. And so this is our koan practice here. This, what did he mean? Every day is a fine day, What did he mean by that silence? How could it... And the encouragement is that there's something here beyond our what catches us. So this is sometimes called Vimalakirti's thundering silence. So what would thundering silence look like? And I think so important as we put ourselves in it to say, well, so what I think of as fine is this, or what I think of silence is, you know, I can't come up with anything. So, yeah, and what other kind of silence is there? And what would it be like? So again, these places where we're irritated, where it doesn't make sense, are the invitation of our way. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. And there's, was it Mike?
I think it was Mike. So, see.
Yeah.
So I heard sickness as longing, and sickness with longing to understand, to be taught what it is, what is truth, what is God. And that longing of those called sickness allow all of those 80,000 bodhisattvas to fit in. And so longing, sickness turns into this beautiful opportunity. Maybe he didn't get his answer as he expected, but it was a beautiful kind of thing that came out of this longing, this sickness.
Yeah. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen talks about the bird and the fish swimming in the air and the sea, and something about when the need is great, the territory is great. So yes, this teaching that when we call out with our true need, that the bodhisattvas respond immediately. There's no gap between the calling out. But I think there is something about the calling out that without going to that place, you know, we have no, there's no space for the world to come to us, for the Dharma, for the bodhisattvas, however we see it. Yeah, thank you. And then Willie, and then...
I'm having second thoughts, but...
Art. I'm first
going back later. To Steve and the Ramboat and Cadigan, okay? Maybe we've all set out in Ramboats, we just don't know it. You know, and we paddle furiously going in circles, but we had good streams. we were on a good current, and the weather was good, and we ended up in a good place. But we thought it was our effort. And other people, not so good. They ended up in bad places. But we believe, you know, that it was our efforts and that it was us, we did it. But really, it was just circumstance.
The great delusion, right? That person's in prison because they did stupid things, and we're not, because we did the right stuff.
That's my point exactly. Yeah. And also... Gee, if I only had paddled harder, I would have ended up in a better place.
This is why two of the worldly winds that we get caught in are praise and blame.
Yeah.
Praise and blame. Over and over and over. I agree completely. That's the issue. Who's responsible? So my thing is always, we as human beings, our sensory apparatus is not set up to take in the whole of reality. So we do our best with the little bitty stuff we can see. So our friends in the prisons who have done what we can say are quite egregious things, murder and terrible things, within their limited capacity in the moments that they acted, it was all they could do. And then life, you know, the boat takes them to the little place. It's our responsibility to widen our view so we get more information. And still, we're going to screw up royally. I guarantee it. It's like the other wish that people have, not that we will live forever. Zen's not going to save us from that. Zen's also not going to save us from making a mess of things. I mean, right? Anybody? Has anybody reached that place? You can tell us in Doksan. But it, maybe it helps a little. Or maybe a lot. Who knows? But I think you're right. The attributing.
I just think it twists the perspective a little bit.
Yeah.
if we accept that, we were all set out in round boats, and maybe it wasn't our efforts, just maybe it was something else.
I agree. That's great. Thank you.
Jeremy?
I love that excerpted from the Vimalakirti Sutra. It's one of my favorites, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about it is that at the same time Vimalakirti says that I'm sick because the world is sick, but in the opening of the sutra, there's also a scene between the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas in which the Bodhisattvas are lamenting the sickness and imperfection of the world, and the Buddha says, "But you don't see clearly." And then he touches his toe to the ground, and everything rolls back. And they use the canonical language of all of these shining Dharma jewels underneath it all, and sort of this perfect Buddha realm. But the fact that the two are juxtaposed in this one text is, to me, that's right at the point.
Yes.
Derek.
I'm sorry, but I grossly disagree with the whole, you know, we're not in jail because we haven't done anything wrong. And the people in jail, well, they just didn't know what they were doing. I mean, like, that's only logical if that person was being, like, clinically insane. You know, like, claiming insanity in court. If you were literally insane, then yeah, you're not responsible for your own actions. But every other circumstance, we are competent people. We are responsible for our actions. So, we all of us are. I just didn't like where that conversation was going.
Well, and I think so. The near enemy here, we're really in that place, and I think you bring up something, bring us back to intention, and that. So if we fall in the emptiness realm, so we're talking in the emptiness realm about everything being fine and being fine beyond life and death, good and bad, we can get into terrible trouble. We need to also honor that what we choose to do with our life, where we give attention, what we say, what we do, has real consequences. And each moment as we sit in our zazen, real consequences, and we are called on to make our utmost effort. And all of these, you know, there are no round boats. There are no, we're lost in the realm of discussion. So let's get back to our zazen.
Can I just say one thing? I think, Derek, this is a perfect example of what I was just talking about, because I can apologize now for not being clear enough in my statement. Of course, people who commit crimes are responsible. But with the limited amount of capacity I had in that moment, I spoke in error, or I spoke in a way that wasn't heard the way I intended. And I think this is the thing I was pointing to. We do this all the time. So in a way, you could say that was a screw-up because there wasn't enough clarity in my language. And then we move on. We get taken the information about being misheard or thinking we were doing something right when it turned out it was really damaging. So I think we're all in that same little boat together. We do our best, but sometimes we really do stupid, terrible, evil, harmful things. This is what it means to be a human being. So the other side of vow is repentance. And without repentance, vow is meaningless, and it just keeps going back and forth, back and forth. That's been my experience anyway. So thank you for that correction. I think really important you said it.